This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Single most important risk is associated with distribution and deployment of vaccines, controlling the pandemic. If we don't control the health crisis, we cannot have an even recovery.
That's Hans Kosi, director of the World Bank's Prospects Group on Africa's challenges in sharing the world economic recovery. Details coming up. Also, a UN-led committee says 350,000 people are facing famine conditions in Ethiopia's Tigray region. And Uganda's largest refugee settlement has been hit by a surge of COVID-19 cases. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The World Bank says the global economy is expected to expand 5.6% in 2021. That would make it the fastest post-recession pace in 80 years, largely on strong rebounds from the world's biggest economies. The bank notes that growth in sub-Saharan Africa will depend on several factors, including the continent's ability to control the COVID-19 pandemic. Reporter Pandirambai has more from Raleigh, North Carolina.
The new estimates on growth are contained in a new report on global economic prospects issued in June. While the World Bank predicts greater than 5% growth for the global economy this year, recovery for sub-Saharan Africa is expected to be somewhat less. Output in the region is predicted to grow by 2.8%, in part because of the slow rate of vaccinations against COVID-19 and to a slowdown in investments in infrastructure. But the report says expected demands for commodities by Africa's main trading partners, the U.S. and China, could increase growth on the continent to 3.3% in 2022. The bank says growth will be highest in the continent's three largest economies, Nigeria, Angola, and South Africa. Expected demand for lucrative exports like oil is projected to boost growth in Nigeria this year by 1.8% and up to 2.1% in 2022. An increased demand for metals and minerals could mean 3.5% growth this year for South Africa and over 5% for Botswana. To a large degree, an economic rebound depends on success in curtailing and ultimately eliminating COVID-19. While the pandemic has claimed many lives, it has also led to massive job losses, increased food prices, a drop in global tourism, and reduced gains in fighting poverty. Ehan Kusi is the director of the World Bank's Prospects Group.
Single most important risk is associated with distribution and deployment of vaccines, controlling the pandemic. If we don't control the health crisis, we cannot have an even recovery. We cannot have the type of strong recovery we would like to have.
Economists say the fight to control COVID-19 in Africa with deficit spending has strained budgets, an issue that could become an impediment to growth and investment. Nyang Jai is a leading Gambian economist.
Countries such as the Gambia and many other countries within the West Africa region and to a large extent Africa made significant expenditures to ward off COVID. But unfortunately, these expenditures were backed mostly by debt. And now this debt has already added to a bloated debt.
Njai suggests that debt forgiveness could hasten Africa's economic recovery. It is a strategy that has been used before by the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to cancel or reduce repayments for heavily indebted poor countries or HIPIC,
Equally, I think it is time at an African level, more so at a regional level, i.e. ECOWAS, to come up with a comprehensive strategy for debt forgiveness that we have seen during the HIPC 1 and HIPC 2 initiative of the 1990s and early 2000s. Debt forgiveness is just one way for the African economies, to be precise, to really rebound and recover.
The World Bank report warns that global growth in Africa and globally could be affected by a rebound of inflation that has accompanied recovering economic activity. In a related matter, the bank cautions policymakers to resist subsidies or price controls that could put in upward pressure on food prices. The report also encourages ways of lowering trade costs by reducing cumbersome logistics and border procedures, moves that could stimulate investment and growth. Economies could also be boosted by sustained investment in infrastructure, greater export diversification, and continued implementation of reforms to improve foreign investment. For VOA News, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
News services are reporting that French President Macron is announcing today that he is cutting the number of French troops who are in sub-Saharan Africa's Sahel region to help fight Islamic extremists. AFP and Reuters say Macron is holding a news conference after a defense cabinet meeting. No figures were immediately available on how many of the 5,100 French troops are being pulled out of the troubled West Africa region. The insurgents have been stepping up deadly attacks on security forces and civilians, and there are concerns that the unrest could spread. A meeting of G7 nations is scheduled for this weekend in the Sahel region is expected to be high on the agenda. Macron has pushed for more Western involvement in the situation. A high-level UN-led committee that focuses on rapid responses on humanitarian crisis estimates 350,000 people in Ethiopia's embattled Tigray region are facing famine conditions. According to the Associated Press, the estimate by the committee was presented at a meeting Monday chaired by UN Humanitarian Chief Mark Lowcock. The committee included UNICEF, the World Food Programme, the High Commissioner for Refugees, the World Health Organization, and the International Committee of the Red Cross. A note from the meeting also said millions of other people in Tigray urgently need food to avoid famine. Mitiku Kasa, head of Ethiopia's National Disaster Prevention and Preparedness Committee, told a news conference today that the yet unpublished declaration of famine in the Tigray region by the UN would be incorrect, saying, "We do not have any food shortage." He accused the remnants of the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, of attacking aid convoys. And in more news from the Tigray region, some 200 bodies have been buried in shallow graves in and around the town of Hauzin, Ethiopia, after more than 7 months of war in the Tigray region. As VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Hauzin, where residents fear the fighting will continue and more people will be killed.
Some mass graves in the Ethiopian town of Hauzin hold dozens of bodies. Some hold only a few. Locals say there are about 20 graves in all, containing bodies that were found in the streets of the town after multiple battles. The most recent happened just a few weeks ago.
The bodies lay out on the ground for 7 or 8 days, and there's no one to help us take them to the church. So a few of us buried them. They smelled bad, rotting, and attracting maggots.
Most Hauzin residents have fled their homes, many to live in crowded camps without enough food. The town itself is in ruins. The families who remain say there is almost no way to make a living. Hauzin has changed hands about 5 times since the war began in November between the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front and Ethiopian and Eritrean forces. Ethiopian troops now control most of the region, including Hausin. But fighting continues, and residents fear war could break out at any moment.
There have been so many bombings in this town. Children have died and houses are destroyed.
In the market, few sellers make any money these days, the woman adds, but they sit there all day, hoping for luck. On the outskirts of Hausin, Lete Gourmet says she doesn't expect much luck in this beleaguered town, as residents continue to bury civilians killed in war. She says among the dead are children and the elderly.
The killing continues. Recently, we buried another 7 bodies near the church.
This war has claimed thousands of lives and left millions of people displaced. Here in Hausin, some say they are no longer afraid because they cannot imagine anything worse could happen. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Hausin, Ethiopia.
The campaign for Algeria's parliamentary elections closed officially yesterday amid concerns over the turnout with both the opposition and the Hirak protest movement against them. About 24 million voters are eligible to take part Saturday. Voters will be able to choose between almost 1,500 candidates, over half of which are running as independents. William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi whether the turnout would affect the legitimacy of the elections.
The fact that the Hirak and the opposition are both against this snap election means that the turnout will be low and perhaps abysmally low. The turnout for the 2017 parliamentary elections was a dismal 35%. And for the constitutional referendum of 2020, which is the basis for this election, it was 24%. By contrast, during Algeria's democratic opening between 1988 and 1992, the turnout was 59%. And I'd be very surprised if the turnout on Saturday is even half of that. Also, election experts will tell you that invalid or spoiled ballots, when they reach the double digits, meaning above 10%, is significant too, because those are in fact protest votes. And in the 2017 election, 21% of the ballots cast were spoiled. The 2020 election, when 80% of the voters stayed home, 11% spoiled their ballots. So actually the turnout is even lower than the official turnout numbers when voters are spoiling their ballots. Boycotts and dismal turnouts are other factors that contribute to low legitimacy, such as the lack of international observers, the total ban on protests, and the arrests of political and civil society activists, bloggers, and traditional journalists. 23,000 Algerians are competing for 407 parliamentary seats, which is much higher than 2017. So the way I view this, and most Algerians view it, is that most of the candidates are running more as a job application than to advance a political vision or policies. Most Algerians just see the candidates as running to control a piece of the economic pie. What most Algerians want is systemic change and a civilian-led government, not controlled by the military, intelligence services, and other deep state forces. They believe that without systemic change, these elections are not really meaningful or legitimate. It's just about distributing the hydrocarbon wealth of the country.
Voters will be able to choose between almost 1,500 lists, over half of which are running as independents. This is the first time such a high number of independent candidates are running against candidates backed by the political parties, which have been largely discredited. Could these newcomers with no stated political affiliation become a new force in the Algerian political scene?
Sure, but not a high or significant force. Most of the power is with the forces behind the president. And elections of a lot of independents, which could happen, has next to no impact on those real forces of power and won't challenge those power bases. In fact, when they're not organized into political parties, it means they're even weaker. So we're witnessing, both in Algeria and in different ways in other countries in the region, a kind of anti-politics. because of high levels of dismay with the political system. So people start believing that the way to engage in politics is by not doing politics, by not having parties, by not having leaders, by not having policy preferences, but rather by protesting from within the system without being interested in running the system. They're more interested in dismantling the government and changing the system. So these new arrivals who want to change the system are really just going to be placeholders until some future systemic change takes place. Now, they will change what happens in parliament. They'll change the debates on the floor of parliament. But in the end, the parliament will be enacting the policies that the president and the powers that be want enacted, ending up being most of the time a rubber stamp and giving formal legitimacy to the executive run by this president, who's only supported by about a third of the population.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Uganda's largest refugee settlement, Bidibidi, has been hit by a surge in COVID-19 cases. It is being blamed on refugees who use porous border points in Uganda's Yaoundé district to cross into South Sudan and back without screening for COVID. In a space of only 2 days, more than 60 cases have been reported in Yaoundé involving refugees. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
Home to over 60,000 South Sudan refugees, Uganda's Yaoundé district is grappling to contain the spread of COVID-19 in the Bidibidi settlement. Authorities are structuring ways to limit the passage of refugees to and from South Sudan in an effort to keep the outbreak from spreading. Solomon Osakan is the refugee desk officer of Uganda's West Nile region. He says authorities have resolved to close the borders to new refugee entry into camps.
The last time new arrivals came, somewhere 10 of them tested COVID positive. Somewhere again, another lot, there were three that tested COVID positive. So it means they are coming with this disease. If we allow them to continue coming, they are going to infect people in the settlement and so many deaths will occur.
Caroline Angoleret is Yaoundé Resident District Commissioner. She says plans are underway to set up COVID-19 screening points at all the porous border crossings to ensure all those found positive are isolated and treated before entering the settlements.
For the settlement camp where the spread is increasing day by day, we have advised our teams on ground to stay vigilant. And then the settlement commandant and UNHCR had to sit with different implementing partners to see how to curb the situation in the settlements. We resolved that. We set up COVID-19 checkpoints in sub-counties across the border for us to be in position to test people who come in. And we also want to strictly monitor those porous border points to mitigate on the movement of these people.
There is growing panic that the uncontrolled movement of refugees could worsen the already surging COVID numbers in Uganda. However, Martin Oroch, the Arua resident city commissioner, is hopeful the recent directive by President Museveni banning inter-district vehicle movement could help in curbing the spread.
I am aware we have some of them who are not in the camp but stay with us in the city here. And once in a while, they move to check on their relatives, and others come from other districts like Yaoundé, Koboko, to Arua. In this case, this directive will apply to everybody. They are not going to move from one district to another. Ministry of Health is arranging to send more testing kits to our health facilities.
Uganda is among the East African countries that included refugees in their COVID-19 vaccination plans. However, vaccination teams have faced a challenge of hesitancy among refugees to take the COVID jab. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Nigeria is struggling with separatist and sectarian violence on several fronts, as well as from a surge in general crime. Reporter Medina Dauda with VOA's Hausa Service recently sat down with the U.S. Ambassador to Nigeria, Mary Beth Leonard, to discuss the U.S. perspective on the challenges facing the country and how the U.S. is helping. In this excerpt, Dauda asks first about the violence from groups seeking independence.
What can you say about the violence with which some groups are pursuing their agitation for independent states.
Well, what I would say is that I think we need to, I hope, come to some agreement on very fundamental truths. Violence against people, the death of people, this destruction of property, attacks on installations, these are crimes. And, you know, I think that the government of Nigeria has a legitimate interest and right to investigate those crimes, to bring people to justice. Those investigations, those processes, of course, must be squarely within judicial processes with an eye towards the human rights and balanced treatment of those who are involved. But I think we need to realize that, you know, violence is not a way to further political ends. Discussion, dialogue is a way to further political ends. And we really encourage everyone to go within constitutional means to address their grievances. You know, it's as I said earlier, there are parallels with situations in the United States. Both have situations in which people who feel that because of where they live or where they're from or what their occupation is or what their ethnic or religious affiliation is, that they are somehow not well served by their government. Well, that's a moment when people should come together in unity to dispel misperceptions, to have conversations about needs, and to try to make this country a better place for all of its citizens.
Now, how do you think the instability in Nigeria will affect its role in providing the needed leadership to resolve regional problems such as the political instability in Mali and Chad?
Well, I mean, clearly, I think it's a related question. Both in Mali and in Chad, insofar as, you know, you are, or in Nigeria, obviously, you know, your attention to those, to the unrest in Mali and Chad takes away from participation in regional security initiatives. And so that's why it's very important and why the U.S. government supports in both cases a return to constitutional rule in accordance with the various processes that have been outlined by the AU or by ECOWAS. I think that Nigeria is actually a formidable regional political leader, even despite its many internal challenges. It's so impressive to see the array of senior Nigerians in positions of leadership at the United Nations, at the AU, and you know, we just saw yesterday the appointment of a special envoy to Lake, or a couple days ago, the appointment of a special envoy to the Lake Chad Basin. And so I think it's very heartening to see Nigeria understand that it's not only about what they do internally, but many of their security challenges are related to their neighbors, and to maintain their activism in those fora in order to bring stability to the region.
What is the U.S. doing to help Nigeria overcome its multiple security challenges? Though you have answered some of that, but do you think the challenges Nigeria is facing is developmental? Is it going to phase out? Do you think so?
Well, I think that the as I mentioned earlier, the security challenges have multifaceted components to them. It's both about creating opportunity, it's about promoting dialogue to resolve things peacefully, and it's about a physical response. I think that my most important message about Nigeria's security challenges is, again, while they may be significant, I do not believe that they are insurmountable. And I believe that with the participation of partners, with consultation and dialogue both at federal and at state level, and involving all Nigerians and reminding all Nigerians that they all can have a positive role to play in these issues, that Nigeria will overcome its current difficulties.
That was Mary Beth Leonard, the U.S. Ambassador to Nigeria, speaking with VOA House of Service Medina Dauda at the ambassador's residence in Abuja. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Uhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the